What would you want those people to know about you?
We're not special. We're just a human being. We have like anybody else's feelings.
Even when she was younger, as a kid, whenever people hurt her feelings, Mary said she would always let them know.
Why did you make that decision to tell them how they made you feel?
It hurt.
How are things different today at L'Arche?
Everyone is equal. Do unto others as I do unto you, and be kind to one another.
And although Mary's been living here at L'Arche for the last 12 years, she's lived in her share of other group homes, one in particular where she lived for only 6 weeks.
It was fenced in.
It was fenced in.
Had dogs and cats.
Dogs and cats.
You had to get up at a certain time. And I had depression on top of it.
So you had depression on top of that. And how did they treat you?
Kind of mean.
Kind of mean.
Was that the worst place you ever lived?
Yeah. The people were nice for us. And the people was not nice. So I moved out.
What did they do?
They would hit me. And I didn't like that. So I moved out.
Neighbors have gathered in front of a closed-down laundromat holding signs saying, "Stay out of my backyard." They're against the laundromat's rezoning as a developer wants to turn it into a restaurant. They say it'll bring too much traffic and noise to their street that it doesn't belong across from their homes. But the lot was rezoned to what's called a planned unit development, or PUD, or PUD, which allows for mixed use, and developers get them all the time. They're the most common type of zoning in Jacksonville, totaling about 190 square miles. Residential developer Nate Day says he relies on them.
Of the last five or six we've done, all but one have been a PUD.
PUDs were originally intended to create mixed-use communities like the San Marcos Square area, a blend of businesses, restaurants, apartments, and single-family homes. But most PUDs these days, 94% of the ones created in the past 2.5 years, have been for single uses, like the neighborhoods Day is developing.
A lot of times, the current code doesn't allow for flexibility.
About 10 days post-Irma, Linda Bennett was still living in her flooded house with two daughters and three grandkids.
Right here. I have to pull that carpet out right there because I had already pulled the carpet out. But you see some carpet right here?
Several feet of water had spilled into her home from the nearby Rebalt River, along with several streets of houses in this low-income area. And in Bennett's home, the floors and beds are soaked, smelling of mildew.
I am very worried about me not only getting sick, but my grandkids getting sick.
A year later, her house is still being repaired.
You know how it was when you came out here the last time. It was really bad, and it was like stink out of here.
She says living that way for several months was really stressful, but hotels accepting FEMA vouchers were booked up, and she didn't want to burden others by staying with them. Around December, volunteers helped tear out the destroyed drywall, but left the bathroom walls intact for privacy.
So when I walked into that bathroom, it was like a punch in my lungs. I mean, it was like so moldy and mildewy. And so I was like, we need to get in here as fast as we can.
Justin Brown, executive director of the nonprofit Builders Care, says her home was one of the first his organization worked on. Another organization, Yellow House, paid for her family to stay in a hotel.
I think we've gotten about 7 families back into safe living in the Kenai Drive area.
Why was it so hard to identify that's what was going on?
I'm not a doctor. And I mean, from my community, you don't really go to see psychiatrists, so... Depression was always a joke to me until I actually really faced it.
You said in your community, you know, you didn't have people around you seeking mental health help.
Well, okay. You asking me what I mean when I say in my community?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, black people for the most part, from a certain level of life, if you haven't been exposed to certain things in regards to psychiatric help, unless you're actually getting thrown in the bus and being forced to go, that's not something that you do.
Shuffle.
Savory Morgan is teaching dance at the Young Men's Leadership Academy just west of downtown. It's a small class, just 4 students who opted in.
So what they do is once a week they come to me instead of going to gym.
The program called Breaking the Barrier for Boys Only is in 4 Duval schools, 32 boys total. Today, these middle schoolers are practicing for a March showcase. 7th grader Travon Richardson says it's his second year, and he likes dance because it's good exercise.
So what's your favorite kind of dance or favorite kind of moves?
Like my favorite one is when we have to run. We gotta turn back around, like we gotta do a slice and come right back over here.
He demonstrates it, running across the room and finishing with a sharp spin. Morgan says it's a contemporary modern move. He's teaching them genres ranging from ballet to hip hop to jazz. Morgan himself used to go to this school. It's a Sunday afternoon in Riverside's Memorial Park, and Maria Garcia is reading a poem at a vigil for someone named Celine Walker.
But I will not cease to fight. Today I mourn and I remember all of my siblings killed because they were transgender.
Garcia's with the local Coalition for Consent. Her group and others organized this vigil as a call for action after Walker was shot dead in a hotel room near the St. John's Town Center early this month. When police publicly called for leads in the case, they identified the victim as Cedric Walker, a man. But everyone here today says Walker was a transgender woman who went by Celine, not the name on her license. Elias Joseph is calling on the sheriff's office to change its practices.
JSO is being super disrespectful, misgendering her, calling her by her dead name, when they really have no reason or cause to do so, even though they claim that they do.
JSO declined an interview, but in an email to WJCT, they say police go by whatever gender ID the medical examiner makes, and Walker's yet-to-be-released autopsy report identifies the victim as a man. End of story.
You know, we're not asking them to talk about her genitalia or anything like that, which is all that medical examiners really look at. We're just asking them to call her by her right name and use different pronouns, which is really not hard.
In emails, JSO also said transgender people have legal avenues for changing their name and gender on official documents, and giving police info that doesn't match is a crime. The ID change process is something local transgender attorney Rusty Mead knows a lot about.
The process can be quite lengthy, and it can be expensive if you're doing it on your own. And even if you're not doing it on your own, if you need the assistance of an attorney. What happens with a lot of transgender folks in particular, you live in a status that makes it hard where you're hard to survive with your basic need, you know, getting your basic needs met.
That difficulty, he says, comes from the discrimination many face. And while official documents are one thing, Mead says that shouldn't be the end of conversation between police and the public.
Why not just talk about it? Why not implement a policy? Why not have a discussion with the community, especially, you know, the community, you know, that is the target of this discussion.
That's exactly what the Seattle Police Department did in 2014 when it hired a full-time LGBT liaison. Here's Officer Jim Ritter.
So having a liaison helps bridge that gap to a community which has not always trusted the police.
This week was the most recent shooting of a transgender woman of color, bringing the number of similar murders nationwide to 13, according to the Human Rights Campaign. And these activists at City Hall Tuesday outside a council meeting say police need to do better.
We need to see an LGBTQ advocacy officer on the ground interacting with this community.
But Williams tells WJCT that part of the policy is evolving. A recent JSO news release mentioned, quote, a transgender victim and listed several names she had used.
There was nothing that we would do intentionally to try to disrespect the victim. I think it was maybe potentially just a lack of sensitivity on our part to address it that way. So after the fact, some of the other cases, follow-up cases, again, there's an investigative benefit to identifying someone by the way that they were identified in the community.
Although he says officers don't know how someone identifies when they're found dead, introducing 4 members of the new liaison team on Thursday, Williams says he hopes they'll help keep the dialogue going. Lindsay Kilbride, 89.9 WJCT News.